Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean of the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. In this first half hour, a newly recorded conversation dealing with current issues and his latest book, Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. In the second half, you'll hear a conversation with him from 2018 on his book, We the People, A Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century. You can learn more at law.berkeley.edu. The show airs its specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, Google Play, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. I turn to Erwin Chemerinsky when I want articulate and meaningful commentary and analysis regarding questions of justice, our legal system, and the courts, especially the Supreme Court. He usually grants me only a half hour, and that is the case again today. So many critical questions and so little time, so I'm going to treat this as much like a lightning round as a conversation. But Professor Chemerinsky is so clear and concise in his thinking that it's always more than worth it. And the Supreme Court has certainly been in the news. Its radically right-wing makeup, sealed with the rushed confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, would be enough to demand our attention. Then, add their recent rulings on issues like abortion, voter suppression, and their approval of religious liberty as a license to discriminate. It's also worth noting that with greater attention has come a lowering of public trust. The current court is but one aspect of a much broader pattern of minority rule. The U.S. holds only one national popular vote, and the Republican Party has won that vote only once since 1988. But during this time, Republican presidents have appointed five Supreme Court justices, and Democratic presidents have appointed only two. A president who lost the popular vote nominated Brett Kavanaugh, who was confirmed by senators who represented only 44% of the population. Erwin Chemerinsky became dean of Berkeley School of Law in mid-2017. From 2008 to 2017, he was the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at UC Irvine School of Law. Prior to that, he was a law professor at Duke University, and before that, at the University of Southern California Law School. In 2017, National Jurist magazine named him as the most influential person in legal education in the U.S. Chemerinsky is the author of more than 200 law review articles, and his books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution and The Case Against the Supreme Court. His latest is Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. In it, he points out that the framers of the Constitution intended many of its provisions to constrain police, to limit what police can do, and to protect the rights of us all. In it, he points out that the framers of the Constitution intended many of its provisions to constrain police, to limit what police can do, and to protect the rights of us all, including those suspected and accused of crimes. But throughout American history, the court has done a poor job of enforcing those provisions. On the contrary, it has consistently empowered police and legitimated the racialized policing that especially harms people of color. Welcome, Erwin Chemerinsky, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. Let me tell listeners, we're recording this interview Monday, September 27th. Now, I turn to Erwin Chemerinsky when I want articulate and meaningful commentary and analysis regarding questions of justice, our legal system, and the courts, especially the Supreme Court. And he usually grants me only a half hour, and that is the case again today. So, many critical questions, little time. I will treat this as much like a lightning round as a conversation, but Professor Chemerinsky is so clear and concise in his thinking that it's always more than worth it. Erwin Chemerinsky became dean of Berkeley Law in mid-2017. From 2008 to 2017, he was the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at UC Irvine School of Law. Prior to that, he was a law professor at Duke University. Before that, the University of Southern California Law School. In 2017, National Jurist magazine named him as the most influential person in legal education in the U.S. He's the author of more than 200 law review articles, and his books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution and The Case Against the Supreme Court. His latest, as I said, is Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. And in this new book, he points out that the framers of the Constitution intended many of its provisions to constrain police, to limit what police can do, to protect the rights of us all, including those suspected and accused of crimes. But throughout American history, the court has done a poor job of enforcing these provisions. On the contrary, according to Chemerinsky, it has consistently empowered police and legitimated the racialized policing that especially harms people of color. Welcome, Erwin Chemerinsky, to Freeform, a World That Just Might Work.
Truly my great pleasure, and thank you for all of your kind words and your introduction.
Very good. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this interview Monday, September 27th. First, I want to spend most of our time today on a number of current issues, but first, let's talk briefly about the new book, Presumed Guilty. Why did you write it? What did you hope to accomplish?
I've been teaching criminal procedure to law students and to undergraduates for many years. And as I go through all the cases over the course of the semester, I realize in decision after decision, the Supreme Court is siding with law enforcement. And the promise that the Constitution offers of checks on the police, that just hasn't been realized. And so I signed a contract in January 2019 to write this book. In the spring of 2020, after the death of George Floyd, my editor said, "How soon can you get me the manuscript?" And finished the book by the end of October of 2020. But it's a book that I've really been working on throughout my career. And it seems so important to point out how the Supreme Court really has empowered the police, and how this has led to racialized policing in the United States.
Yeah. I'm going to read a quote from you. I think neither the text of the Constitution nor the framers' intents supports a lot of these rulings. Instead, we must regard the court's decisions as a consistent choice throughout American history to favor the interest of law enforcement over the rights of individuals and to ignore the racism that has infected policing since the nation's first days. Let me set this up very quickly, which is there's a format that I use sometime called It's Broke, Let's Fix It. Three questions: evidence that the system is broken, how did we get here, and how do we fix it? So in terms of the Supreme Court and policing, evidence that they've erred in the direction you say, how, why that happened, and then quickly some of the solutions you propose.
In terms of the evidence, the statistics support it. A black man in the United States has 9 times the chance of being killed compared to a white person in the United States. A Latinx person has 4 times the chance of being killed by the police compared to a white person in the United States. Study after study in every major city has shown that black and Latinx individuals are much more likely to stop by the police, holding all else constant, even though whites are more likely to stop found to have contraband or weapons. In terms of the evidence, the Supreme Court has made it possible for the police to stop any person at any time and search them. Or another example I talk about in the book, since 1986, when William Rehnquist became Chief Justice, through today, there's only been 1 Supreme Court case dealing with eyewitness identifications. And yet study after study shows innocent people get convicted because of inaccurate eyewitness identifications, like at lineups or photo IDs. Social psychologists tell us that people are particularly flawed when they're identifying those of other races, and yet the Supreme Court has completely ignored the problem.
Let me jump to one question. Can you briefly explain to people what it is and where it stands, qualified immunity?
It's important to separate in analysis the rights that people possess and the remedies that exist when a violation of right occurs. We were talking just a moment ago about the rights that people possess, but rights are meaningless unless they can be enforced. And one way of enforcing rights is to sue police officers who violate them. But the Supreme Court has made it very difficult and often impossible to sue police officers through this doctrine of qualified immunity. It says a police officer can be held liable only if the officer violates a clearly established right that every officer should know. As recently as 2018, the Supreme Court said, qualified immunity acts to protect all but the plainly incompetent officer.
Wow. And so possible solutions given the makeup of the current Supreme Court.
It's not going to come from the Supreme Court. But Congress, state legislatures, city councils, police commissions can impose reforms in policing. Congress has a bill, it's passed the House, installed in the Senate, that would change the standard for qualified immunity. That would prohibit police from using chokeholds. That would require the police to record the race of those who are stopped, which is a key way of limiting racial profiling. Well, if Congress doesn't do this, and so far it doesn't look like it's going to get through the Senate, state legislatures can adopt laws that expand liability for police under state law, that do things like prohibit the chokehold. And if states don't do it, cities can do it. After the death of George Floyd, many cities prohibited the use of the chokehold by their police officers. Some cities now require written consent in order to have a police search based on consent. So there are many actors who can reform police. State Supreme Courts, using state constitutions, can control the police. The United States Department of Justice, under federal law, can sue police departments for a pattern and practice of civil rights violations.
Very good. So it's going to, with this makeup, which, given the youth of some of the new appointments, maybe they're quite a while, it's going to have to move to other things. And then perhaps something might end up in the Supreme Court on appeal, but the initiative, as you point out, is going to have to be taken elsewhere. And in fact, in places like California, and as you point out, a lot of cities following the summer's demonstrations, these things are happening. Okay. Let's move to other issues. Roe v. Wade, your response to the court's letting stand the Texas anti-abortion law.
Outrageous. The Texas law prohibits abortion effectively at the sixth week of pregnancy. Now, this means it's measured by 6 weeks after the woman's last menstrual period. It means many women don't even know that they're pregnant at that point in time. Roe versus Wade in 1973 said states cannot prohibit abortions before viability. In 1992, Planned Parenthood versus Casey said, quote, the essential holding of Roe versus Wade, that states can't prohibit abortions prior to viability. Viability is about the 24th week of pregnancy. The Texas law prohibits abortions long before viability. It's clearly unconstitutional, but the five most conservative justices, Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, refuse to enjoin it.
Okay, and is what they've done so far considered by you and others as having overruled Roe v. Wade, or does that wait for their ruling on this Mississippi case that's upcoming?
They have not effectively or explicitly overruled Roe, except by not enjoining the Texas law. Most of the abortion facilities in Texas have closed. So it's as if they had done so. Just to be clear, no opinion came down from the court on September 1st about the Texas law. So we can't say that in an opinion the court has overruled Roe. That's going to wait for the Mississippi law. But if you speak about the practical reality, women in Texas can't get abortions.
Right. It reminds me of back in the 60s, segregation. De facto, de jure, right? And they may not have made a ruling yet, but the fact in Texas stands.
Exactly right. Roe versus Wade is still the meaning of the Constitution. Texas is violating the Constitution, but the Supreme Court is allowing them to get away with it. And because of the Texas law, the places in Texas that perform abortions have closed.
Okay. And we'll see this. Someone has, we don't have time really to go into the whole vigilante, method of enforcement that they've put in this law so they can attempt to get around, the Supreme Court, but that will be tested soon. One of the things that struck people about their, silence, on this, was we've seen a lot of talk recently about the Supreme Court shadow docket. What is it? Is the court actually using it more? And what can be done about it?
The shadow docket is where matters come to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis. The justices are asked to issue an injunction or essentially overturn, stay an injunction from a lower court. There's no full briefing. There's no oral argument in the Supreme Court. There's been a dramatic increase in the court issuing rulings on the so-called shadow docket in recent years. And what's troubling about that is the court is issuing rulings without the benefit of the deliberative process, without having briefing and oral argument. And the court's very inconsistent in terms of when it is and isn't willing to issue injunctions or stay injunctions.
Yeah, and it seems to me where we used to see it was a lot of times on capital punishment cases. Do we stay this execution or not? Where the emergency, there was an emergency. Timing was of essence. And now it just seems a way to sort of avoid the process we expect of the Supreme Court.
You're right. There have always been matters that come to the Supreme Court on an emergency basis. Frequently in the past, it was people who were facing execution asking the Supreme Court to stay the execution. But we really saw an increase in recent years. Let me make this less abstract by a concrete example. Congress refused to fund President Trump building a border wall. So President Trump said he would just divert money from elsewhere in the Defense Department to do so. Federal District Court issued a preliminary injunction saying, you can't do that. You don't have the spending power. But the Supreme Court stepped in and stayed the injunction, and so Trump was able to build the border wall. There, the justices had no problem using the shadow docket issue injunction. But then you get the Texas case on September 1st, and the justices refused to issue an injunction against a blatantly unconstitutional law.
Very good. Supreme Court reform. During the election campaign, there was a lot of talk about reforming the Supreme Court to deal with the 6-3 right-wing majority created by McConnell's refusal to consider Merrick Garland and then controversial confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh and rapid confirmation of Coney Barrett. Where did those talks or those possibilities stand now, as far as you can see?
President Biden did what politicians often do. He said he would create a commission to study it. And he created a presidential commission to study the Supreme Court. He made it very large and very diverse and said, give me a report by November. And the committee said, we're not going to make any recommendations. I am skeptical that anything useful is going to come from this commission. But I'm also skeptical we're going to see any meaningful reforms, because anything that could be done can be filibustered in the Senate. And you know Republicans aren't going to approve things like increasing the size of the Supreme Court.
Exactly. I'll tell you what, you mentioned the word filibuster. In May, I saw you debate the filibuster, and I thought your approach and your attack was spot on. And one of the things that you said, for example, to the knee-jerk objection that Democrats will not always be in the majority and they could come to regret this move if they did away with the filibuster once Republicans retake control, you pointed out so simply that it makes no difference what the Democrats do, because if the Republicans are in power and want to do it, they'll do it. Any other things to say about the filibuster, which it seems at this moment may be absolutely necessary to pass anything on a federal level that has to do with election integrity?
The filibuster is not provided for in the Constitution. It's not provided for in a federal statute. It's created by Senate rules. And it means that senators representing a small minority of the population can block legislation. As we're talking, as you said on Monday, September 27th, we face the possibility of a government shutdown. We face the possibility for the first time in American history, the United States defaulting on its debts just because of the filibuster. There's not going to be meaningful legislation with regard to voting reform or police reform or so many other topics because of the filibuster. I think the filibuster is unconstitutional, and I think it's terribly unwise.
Okay. Religion. I'm going to read a quote from you. I believe, never before has the Supreme Court allowed secular corporations to claim religious freedom. People create corporations to protect themselves from liability by making the corporation a separate entity. The investors are liable only to the extent of investment. The corporation is an entity that's treated as legally separate from the individuals to run it. But now the Supreme Court has ruled occasionally that corporations sort of have religious freedom. And what we're seeing is a distortion, it seems to me, of what the meaning of religious freedom has been. It has usually been to protect the right of people to practice religion. But now it is protecting the right of people to discriminate against others and claim religious defense.
Everything you say is absolutely right. Let me take it backwards. The last point that you made was the current court is allowing people to use their religious beliefs to discriminate against others. In June of 2021, in Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, the court said that Catholic social services had a right to contract with the city as to foster care placements, even though it refused to place children with same-sex couples. Philadelphia used private social service agencies to do these placements, but said that they couldn't discriminate based on race, sex, religion, sexual orientation. Catholic social service went to court and said, our religion requires that we discriminate in same-sex couples, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Catholic social services. I think we're going to see this come to the Supreme Court in cases where employers say they don't want to hire gay, lesbian, or transgender individuals because the employer's religious beliefs, where there's cases that involve bakeries or florists or videographers who refuse to serve same-sex weddings. Even when this violates state law, I think the Supreme Court's going to say they have a right to discriminate on account of their religious beliefs. What you said at the beginning is, I don't think a corporation can have a religious belief. We think of religion as being about an individual's conscience. Corporations, as the quote you read said, exist to have an entity apart from the individual, so that if the corporation goes bankrupt, the individual faces no monetary liability. And yet the Supreme Court in Burwell versus Hobby Lobby in 2014 specifically said that corporations could have religious freedom and could refuse to provide contraceptive coverage to women on the basis of that.
Yeah. I mean, the idea that a corporation can have a religious notion of any sort is insane. And one thing that we don't have time to talk about, but I just have to point out, is why so many Catholics, huh? In 1960, it was a big deal that John F. Kennedy could run for president as a Catholic. And now do we have 6 out of 9?
Yeah, there's an easy explanation for this. Let me be clear. I don't think anyone should be chosen or not chosen
right
for the Supreme Court or any position, that kind of religion. But there is an interesting point that 6 of the 9 justices are Catholic. One is Episcopalian, was raised Catholic, and 2 Jewish justices. Why is that? Republican presidents have wanted to send a message to their base that they're appointing people who are strongly opposed to abortion rights. Appointing conservative Catholics was a way to send that message. Donald Trump, for example, said he wanted to appoint justices committed to overruling Roe versus Wade. So we shouldn't be surprised that he appointed Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh, who are Catholic, and Neil Gorsuch, who was raised Catholic.
Yeah. One other place where you point out this thing about, you know, some of the questions about religion is in terms of vaccine mandates. You say there should be no religious exemptions. Take that.
The Supreme Court said in 1990 that we don't give exceptions to general laws on account of religious beliefs. It was Justice Antonin Scalia who said that. He said, given the tremendous diversity of religion in this country, we can't begin to give exceptions for religious beliefs. Also, if we do give an exception to a general law for religious belief, courts are going to face the impossible question of what is religion and how we decide what's sincerely held religious belief. So I believe that if the government wants to require that everyone be vaccinated with no religious exceptions, it clearly can do so. In fact, every state requires children be vaccinated against a variety of communicable diseases in order to go to school.
Yep.
A number of states do this, giving no opportunity for religious exemptions to vaccination. every court to consider this has upheld the mandatory vaccination laws, even without any religious exception.
Okay, finally, this is one where when I throw it to you, take it wherever you want, but I want to talk at the end here about minority rule. And anyone that listens to this show knows, is aware of the challenges presented to democracy by gerrymandering, voter suppression, election manipulation. The Republican Party, its beliefs and its policies, this is my take, while passionately held by millions, are no longer those of the majority of Americans. And so the only way that they can survive, and in fact, as they do now, dominate in some ways, is to game the system. The U.S. holds only one national popular vote, that for president and vice president, and the Republican Party has won that national vote only once in the last 32 years. And yet they've held the presidency for 12 of those years. And as you point out, they have appointed the great majority of Supreme Court justices over this time. Minority rule, as I said, it has to do with gerrymandering, voter suppression, election manipulation, the new laws being passed where legislatures can overrule election commissions and so on. What do we do? Because I think that minority rule is a cancer on democracy and ultimately will breed cynicism, resignation, and worse.
I totally agree with you. It is not hyperbole to say our democracy is in grave danger. Some of this traces back to the Constitution. The Electoral College is what creates the possibility for minority rule with regard to the presidency. Giving every state 2 senators, regardless of size, creates possibility in the reality of minority rule. But it's gotten worse in recent years. The Supreme Court in 2019 saying that federal courts can't hear challenges to partisan gerrymandering. The Supreme Court in decisions in 2013 and 2021 gutting the Voting Rights Act, making it very difficult, not impossible, to challenge the laws being passed in places like Texas, Georgia, Florida, that will clearly disadvantage minority voters.
Okay, what can be done about it, especially given, as we've said all along, the makeup of the court at 6-3, and I don't even believe it's conservative. I say it's right wing. But and given that and the youth of a number of the nominees, how are we going to stop this minority rule besides just massive get-out-the-vote campaigns?
Well, massive get-out-the-vote campaigns are crucial. Look what happened in Georgia,
yep,
where Georgia elected 2 Democratic senators and also went for Joe Biden in the presidential race. I think it's absolutely essential that Congress pass a voting rights law. There's now 3 different bills that have been introduced. Some, I think, are better than others, but any of them would be better than nothing. The key is that Joe Manchin has to be persuaded to eliminate the filibuster, at least for this bill, because the Republicans will block any voting reform by filibuster. And if the Democrats don't change the filibuster, nothing will happen. But we can't rely on the Supreme Court, and that's why we've got to change federal law. And there's so many things that can be done to make us more of a democratic nation.
You can learn more at law.berkeley.edu. Dean Chemerinsky's latest book is Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. Thank you again, Irwin, and keep up the good work.
Truly my pleasure. Thank you.
I'll be back in just a moment with an earlier conversation with Irwin Chemerinsky on his book, We the People. Here's my conversation with Irwin Chemerinsky, recorded in 2018. In addition to covering legal issues of the day and in the middle of the Trump administration, there were plenty. We talked about his newest book at the time, We the People, a progressive reading of the Constitution for the 21st century. In it, he asks why a nation that believes in democratic rule should be governed by a document that none of us voted for and that can be changed only by supermajorities in Congress and of the states. He urges progressives to expose how conservatives are using the Constitution to advance their own agenda, which favors business over consumers and employees and government power over individual rights, and to offer their own vision for what the Constitution should be understood to mean and how this view far better achieves the goals of our nation, as stated in the preamble of ensuring democratic rule, effective government, justice, liberty, and equality. Erwin Chemerinsky is Dean of the University of California, Berkeley School of Law, the author of more than 200 law review articles, and his books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution and The Case Against the Supreme Court. Erwin Chemerinsky became Dean of Berkeley Law in mid-2017. From 2008 to 2017, he was the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at UC Irvine School of Law. Prior to that, he was a law professor at Duke University, and before that, at the University of Southern California Law School. In 2017, National Jurist magazine named him as the most influential person in legal education in the United States for the second year in a row. He is the author of more than 200 law review articles. His books include The Conservative Assault on the Constitution, The Case Against the Supreme Court, and his latest, as I said, We the People, a progressive reading of the Constitution for the 21st century. Welcome, Erwin Chemerinsky, to Freeform, a world that just might work. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this interview Wednesday, December 12th, 2018.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Okay. Could you tell us briefly about the new book you just published this year?
I think it's important that progressives articulate and defend a vision of the Constitution. We're at a time of a very conservative Supreme Court. It's going to be that way for the foreseeable future. We are having increasingly conservative federal courts of appeals. Donald Trump will have had 30 nominees confirmed for the Federal Court of Appeals in his first 2 years. Barack Obama had 55 confirmed in 8 years. George W. Bush had 62 confirmed in 8 years. It's likely that a significant percentage of the federal judiciary will be appointed by Donald Trump. In light of this, I think the question is, what are progressives going to do? And I wanted to write a book saying we should not give up a progressive vision of the Constitution. We should articulate it. We should defend it.
Okay. And briefly, your thoughts about the refusal to deal with Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland and then the subsequent recent confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh.
What happened with regard to Merrick Garland was unprecedented in American history. 24 times in American history prior to 2016, there's a vacancy near the last year of a president's term. In 21 of 24 instances, the nominee got confirmed. In 3 instances, the Senate didn't confirm. But never before had the Senate said, no hearings, no vote.
So let me just remind people what you just said, that the Republicans, especially when it comes to judicial, claim they're originalists, claim that they, are the Constitution as written, blah, 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 and yet were willing to take an unprecedented action never before in the history of the Union. And as you said, 24 times a vacancy had turned up within the last year of a president's term. Any thoughts about the confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh? I would say specifically the question of temperament as displayed in those hearings.
The nomination of Brett Kavanaugh led to a confirmation battle that in so many ways was unprecedented in American history. There's really never been anything like what we saw. There's never been a closer vote for a nominee. Kavanaugh was confirmed 50 to 48. The prior closest vote for confirmation was for Clarence Thomas, which was 52 to 48, which was back in 1991. But the partisanship, the lack of judicial temperament that was shown on that day in October really has no analog in American history. For Brett Kavanaugh to say this was all a smear by those who support the Clintons and to make it so blatantly political really doesn't have any precedent.
Yeah, and what we're saying there is that this notion that the judiciary is impartial, the judiciary is nonpartisan, he, in his own statements on national television, not just in a closed hearing, everyone saw he was willing to make political statements about those hearings and about his confirmation. This is going to be a simple one, a softball, Erwin Chemerinsky. What are your expectations of this newly constituted conservative court? And take your time if you want to place it in the context of the cycles back and forth of conservative and progressive Supreme Courts.
I think we're going to have the most conservative court that there's been since the mid-1930s. I think we're going to see it especially as the most high-profile controversial issues. I think there's now 5 votes to either explicitly or effectively overrule Roe v. Wade. There are 5 votes now to eliminate all forms of affirmative action. There are 5 votes now to very much limit gay and lesbian rights. In terms of history, eras on the Supreme Court last a long time. There was an era from the 1890s to 1936, where there was a very conservative court that struck down over 200 federal, state, and local laws affecting workers and consumers. From 1937 to 1969, there was a court that had a majority of justices appointed by Democratic presidents. It became increasingly more liberal, especially in the 1960s under Chief Justice Earl Warren. The court's next era began in 1969 when Richard Nixon had 2 nominees confirmed. From 1969 until February 13, 2016, when Justice Scalia died, there were always at least 5 and sometimes as many as 8 justices appointed by Republican presidents. But all during this time, there was a swing justice on the court. There was a Lewis Powell, a Sandra Day O'Connor, an Anthony Kennedy, to join with the liberals in some of those controversial areas I mentioned. Now there's no longer a swing justice. Now there are 5 very ardent conservatives in the majority. And we're going to see the manifestation of that with regard to things like abortion, affirmative action, gay and lesbian rights, punishment in criminal cases.
Mm-hmm. And you, in some of the articles I've read recently, you make clear how much Kennedy was the swing justice on the one hand. On the other hand, that he voted with the conservatives 75% of the time. How do we demonstrate how clearly he was the swing?
Well, just what you said, when the court was split 5-4 over the last 30 years, Kennedy was with the conservatives 75% of the time, with the liberals 25% of the time. 2 years ago, when the court was split 5-4 or 5-3, Kennedy was the liberals 57% of the time, and the conservatives 43% of the time. But I think qualitatively is even more important than quantitatively.
Mm-hmm.
You look at abortion. 2 years ago, Kennedy was the 5th vote to strike down a law in Texas that would have closed most facilities in that state where abortion is performed. 2 years ago, it was Kennedy who wrote the opinion upholding the University of Texas Affirmative Action Program. In every Supreme Court decision in American history expanding rights for gays and lesbians, Kennedy wrote the majority opinion.
Okay. In the past, there have been ideological surprises in the Supreme Court. And Earl Warren was appointed by Eisenhower. Some that were thought to, I know there was one you mentioned that was told this guy's a home run. Maybe that was Souter, and he ended up being much more middle of the road than that, a home run conservative. We don't expect surprises from Gorsuch or Kavanaugh. Why not?
First, surprises are relatively unusual. Felix Frankfurter was a liberal who became very conservative on the court. Harry Blackmun was a conservative who became liberal. But those are the rare exceptions. Most people don't have major ideological transformation when they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s. Clarence Thomas was very conservative when he came on the court in 1991. He's just as conservative today. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was liberal when she came on the court in 1993. She's no different today. And we go through so many examples of people who, throughout their career, were very much ideologically the same. Second, there's much more screening for ideology at this point than there's been at prior points in history. Dwight Eisenhower was not a particularly ideologically defined president. Though Republican, he picked a Democrat, William Brennan, for the court. I don't think that Earl Warren was a surprise. He'd just never been a judge before, so we didn't know much about his judicial record. But I think biographies of Warren show us that what he did as a justice very much followed what he'd been as a governor and as attorney general. David Souter was a surprise, but it's because no one knew much about what he was going to say on the controversial issues. John Sununu told President George H.W. Bush that Souter would be a home run, but it turned out that Souter was much more liberal than anyone realized. But it's not that he changed once on the court.
Okay. Now, it's my assessment, and I'm not alone. I've been, you know, reading on this and so on for a long time, that the Constitution as a document is, I'm going to say, weaker than many believe. It has more holes than many believe, and that Republicans over the last decades, certainly, have been doing a really good job of taking advantage of those gaps, those weaknesses. Is that a reasonable assessment?
The Constitution is written in very open-ended language. It was written in 1787 for an agrarian slave society. There are countless issues that have to be resolved that the Constitution doesn't speak to. Can the president fire a member of the cabinet? Can the president rescind a treaty? There's nothing in the Constitution about those. Or think about, when can the government regulate the internet? There's obviously nothing in the Constitution about that at that level of specificity. I think that conservatives have done a very good job of putting forth the rhetoric that conservative judges just apply the law. They don't make the law. They're just umpires. And what liberals need to argue, what I try to argue in my book, is that's nonsense. Constitutional law is inevitably, in terms of the decisions of the Supreme Court, a function of who are the justices. That's why conservatives fought so hard to get Brett Kavanaugh there. That's why conservatives fought so hard to block Merrick Garland. The recognition of who's on the bench determines the outcome of the cases. And in my book, I try to argue that it very much is about the values of the justices, and here's what the values should be as we look to the Constitution for the future.
Republicans, in my view, are operating in an anti-democratic manner. The demographics are against them, et cetera, et cetera. Even leaving aside Trump's attacks on norms and institutions, including the press, the Justice Department, and so on, there's the party's voter suppression. Now the programs of lame duck state legislatures to weaken or undermine Democratic office holders elected in the recent midterms, to make their hold over the office through gerrymandering and these other things overextend beyond their popularity among the citizenry. Does the Constitution offer us protections against these sort of actions?
Sometimes, and sometimes not. Let's give some examples of not. The Electoral College. The Electoral College is incredibly anti-democratic. There's no other democracy in the world where the person who loses the votes for the highest office could then be deemed to be elected. And yet Donald Trump lost by 3 million votes, and yet because of the Electoral College president. There's no solution for that, really, without amending the Constitution. There's certainly some ways in which we can lessen the effects of the Electoral College. The United States Senate. Every state has two senators, regardless of its size. That's tremendously anti-democratic. I don't think there's a way of solving that without a constitutional amendment. On the other hand, partisan gerrymandering is a practice that I think the Supreme Court should declare unconstitutional, and it is a way in which a minority can entrench itself and gain control over government. In North Carolina, a purple state, Barack Obama carried it in 2008, Romney in 2012, Trump in 2016. Republicans got a slight majority of the seats for the state legislature, then drew legislative districts to give them safe seats in a supermajority of the districts and a control of 10 of 13 congressional districts. That should be unconstitutional.
Now, one of the things that you allude to, certainly in talking about the Senate and also applies to the Electoral College, is the urban-rural divide, which it seems to me, in an effort to get the Constitution passed, the original signers kind of enshrined in the Constitution, and it has only in the 21st century and the late 20th century begun to really show how enormous this distinction is, that we seem to have one country reside in our cities, and that's the country of, you know, of immigration, of technological innovation, et cetera, et cetera, of progressive thoughts about gender and so on. And then the rural, very different. What do you think that means for the future of this country?
I think it's part of a deep polarization. I think our country is more polarized than it's been at any time since Reconstruction. I think the question is, can a country that's this polarized, where there's such antipathy between the two sides, function in the long term as a nation? And if not, what can cure the polarization? I don't have a good answer for either of those.
Okay, and yeah, that's sort of what scares me too, is that I see the problems confronting us, whether it's climate change, technological disruption, are almost existential problems for us as human beings and as members of a society, and in this fractious, divided, partisan atmosphere we're in, I'm afraid we're not up to solving them, and that scares me. You have laid out that the reason you wrote this book is to call attention to the agenda of the Republicans vis-a-vis the Supreme Court and vis-a-vis the judiciary, and to call Democrats to wake up and take on some sort of a similar approach. And you point out that that you sort of begin from the preamble of the Constitution in sort of making that argument. Would that be fair to say?
Yes, it is. The Republicans and conservatives realized decades ago, when they did not have control of the court, that they needed a long-term strategy. And it needed to include articulating a conservative vision for constitutional law. They did that. Now they have justices to implement it. I'm urging progressives to do the same thing. And that's why I wrote this book. And we have to start with, what are the underlying values of the Constitution? And it's striking to me how much you find them in the preamble of the Constitution. It says that the Constitution exists to create democratic governance, to ensure that it's effective governance, to establish justice, to secure liberty. And the value that I'd add to it, that's not mentioned in the preamble, is equality. And what I want to argue in the book is, take each of these values and let's think about how to embody them from a progressive standpoint.
Okay, and I'm going to, just for time's sake, I'm going to read some quotes from you about the way that this conservative agenda has embodied itself. Quotes on a few issues. Few issues so closely correspond to ideology and political party affiliation as the meaning of the Second Amendment. From 1791 until 2008, the Supreme Court never invalidated any law as violating the Second Amendment. And then in June 2018, the Supreme Court dealt a severe blow to you. In June of 2018, they did so.
The case that struck down a law for violating the Second Amendment for the first time was June of 2008. It was District of Columbia versus Heller.
And then in June 2018, the Supreme Court dealt a severe blow to unions by holding that non-union members cannot be required to pay the share of the union dues that support the collective bargaining activities of the union. Liberals see the Establishment Clause, the establishment of separation of church and state, as, in the words of Thomas Jefferson, creating a wall separating church and state. Conservatives interpret this provision narrowly as only prohibiting the government from establishing a church or coercing religious participation. So we've talked guns, unions, church and state. In a series of ideologically divided 5-4 decisions with Justice Scalia in the majority, the Supreme Court in recent years has greatly protected businesses at the expense of injured consumers and employees. And the Roberts Court has been the most pro-business court since the mid-1930s, virtually always in 5-4 rulings. So unions, business, guns, religion. So there's a clear movement in the conservative direction over the last few years. How would, and you know, you've said briefly, and for those who want to check, I mean, starting in the 70s, really, the conservatives began a program, as you said, their long term, their long plan of nurturing college students, law school students, young clerks, and so on, the Federalist Society, moving people up through, the Brett Kavanaughs of the world, the Neil Gorsuches. How do you imagine a counter program from the Democratic or progressive side?
To start with, I think we need to articulate, what is that progressive vision of the Constitution? What do we want the Constitution to be about? And so take the values that I talked about, democratic governance. Well, I think we need to figure out how to reform the Electoral College. We need to figure out how to deal with racism in voting and disenfranchisement. We need to deal with partisan gerrymandering. We need to think about, what's the progressive vision in terms of separation of powers? We need to really look seriously at the criminal justice system, which is so biased against people of color. And if we got, what would we do to create a fair criminal justice system? We need to think about liberty in terms of privacy, in terms of religious freedom. We need to talk about it in terms of equality and how do we create a law that really does provide for equal protection and ultimately provides for much more economic justice. And that's why I wrote this book, to try to say all of those things.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that I think the progressives, Democrats, and so on have been playing defense in judicial rulings, defense on the Supreme Court. And what you're saying is articulate a vision of what the values that America was founded on call for, and then. But still, once they articulate the vision, given the number of conservative, young conservative justices that have been appointed by Trump, given the youth of Roberts, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, how does, after you articulate the vision, how do you actually begin to move that forward?
Hopefully it's by electing a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate. There will be vacancies, and additional seats can be created. Congress can expand the size of the lower federal courts, and we need to do that. And that would then allow the Democratic president, when there's one, to help counterbalance all of the judges that Trump has put there. And I think if there's a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress in 2020, then need to think about, should we expand the size of the Supreme Court to reclaim the seat that was really stolen as a result of the Merrick Garland fiasco?
Talk about that for a second. I would imagine that would be one of those, oh, my God, this is, you know, the earth will turn on its axis. You know, things will. But it really, there's nothing that says they can't do that, correct?
The number of Supreme Court justices is not set by the Constitution. It's set by a federal statute. It's varied over the course of American history between 5 and 10. Because of a historical accident, it became 9 in the late 1860s. But Congress could change that again. I think that's something that's premature to talk about at this point. I think for progressives to discuss it now is just a reason for people who might not otherwise vote in 2020 to come out for Republicans. But I think it's something that if the Democrats get the White House and Congress in 2020 that really needs serious consideration.
Okay. One of the things that some people have suggested is that the Supreme Court should give up judicial review. You take that on seriously, but you come down on the other side.
I do. It's tempting in light of what the Supreme Court is and the lower federal courts are going to be to say, let's just take the Constitution away from the courts. And yet I think about the people who I've represented. I've represented people on death row. I represented a homeless man challenging a Ten Commandments monument in Texas. I've represented a Guantanamo detainee. I've represented people challenging the sentence under three strikes. For my clients, it's really the courts are nothing. I've lost a lot of these cases, but when's the last time that a legislature adopted a law to provide more rights to criminal defendants? When's the last time a legislature adopted a law to give more rights to prisoners? And so I think that the Constitution is meant to protect minorities that aren't going to be protected through the political process. And if we eliminate the courts, we eliminate any chance of their having protection.
Erwin Chemerinsky, we've talked mostly here about the ideas in the book, We the People, of Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century, your new book, and people can learn more at law.berkeley.edu. I've listened to a couple of speeches you've made recently on free speech, and I just think it's such an issue that is fraught, you know, that's in the public eye, that's fraught with emotion and so on. You point out that free speech only has to do with the government, and that there are three exceptions to free speech. Go ahead, just if you could give people that quick lesson.
First, free speech, like almost all constitutional rights, only limits what the government can do. So if somebody works for a public institution, a government institution, like I do at University of California, Berkeley, we have protection of free speech. But if somebody works for a private company or a private university, then the Constitution doesn't apply. There are many exceptions with regard to free speech where the Supreme Court has said that speech can be punished. Child pornography is not protected by the First Amendment. False and deceptive advertising. Incitement of illegal activity. Obscenity. True threats. And so on. I, in talking about college campuses, often focus on three, but there's more exceptions than that.
Okay. Finally, there are some people who call for a constitutional convention to handle some of these problems. Do you come down on one side of that or not?
I'm very frightened of a constitutional convention.
As am I.
What if the constitutional convention was comprised of, like the current Congress, an ideology? The majority was Trump voters, and I don't know how we'd prevent that. If there was such a constitutional convention, I think it would be a far worse document than what we have today. So in some ways, like here, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't.
Yeah. I mean, that same urban-rural divide, I think, would be the constitutional convention would just make that so absolutely clear, and you'd have sort of past America versus future America, and hell would be to pay. So again, the website is law.berkeley.edu, and the books are Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights, and We the People, a progressive reading of the Constitution for the 21st century. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. All one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and at other podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at Apple Podcasts and other sites. Listen anytime, anywhere. Archives include Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter, @McNallyTerrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely.